Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Event Horizon radio program here on Astronomy.fm Radio. It is another Friday evening. This one just happens to be July the 7th, 2017, for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So that would make it universal time at 1 o'clock in the morning, July the 8th in 2017. My name is Marty Coons with my co-host.
Good evening, everybody. It's Nicky Vetch, 2 Echo Zero, Lima Uniform November.
And probably Starstorm mumbling in the background, too.
Good evening.
There she is. Yep. Hello, Starstorm. Well, Friday evening, hot summertime for us, coming up on full moon, getting ready for a solar eclipse, which I've been starting to actually get serious about. It's not quite down to the last week or so, so I'm not that serious about it, but getting closer. Did you definitely make some plans to get somewhere, Nick? Are you going to try?
I'm not going to bother. I'll be honest, I'm not going to bother. I have got a couple of other projects on at the moment, which are keeping me fairly busy. Mm-hmm. Saying that, everybody's going to hear it after. My first project I'm involved with, they're going to hear right after the show. So I'll let you all get all wound up in anticipation about what's coming up next after this show.
I think it's only about half a day's drive south for you, isn't it, to the Carolinas? Not so bad.
Yeah, but the thing is getting the time off. My employer is notoriously, how can I put it,
why is your usual days off?
Well, they've already blocked out the whole of August.
Oh, that's too bad. I think you'd always call in sick on just
actually,
a Monday.
It's a whole day drive from where I am. Thank you, Rob.
Is it? I was kind of wondering how far down from New York to South Carolina, I think it is. South Carolina, North Carolina, one of the two, something like that.
But as I say, I've got two projects on the go. I've got a third on the back plate. And, of course, I have Comet Watch, which is going to be recorded. We're recording the next show next weekend. And the August show is probably going to be slap bang in the middle of eclipse time.
Mm.
But as I say, I got bills to pay, so...
Everybody does, but how often do you get one of these? Yeah.
Well, I saw the last partial eclipse from the UK anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, and to be honest, I'm a nighttime guy. I'm not a solar astronomer. Rob Black's probably going to be grinding his teeth at me, and maybe Stephen Ramsden are, but that's okay. That's fine. But to be honest, yeah, it would be nice. Maybe I can quietly look at it online at work, put my phone onto it whilst mm-hmm. I'm working. But as I say, I'm too busy at the minute, and I've got other things I'm trying to get done. I'm trying to get my telescope upgrades done. I'm trying to get the all-sky camera outside and all sorted out. I've got a few things that I need to do indoors before I can do that. So like I said, I'm up to here with projects at the minute. That and, of course, I'm also sending pictures to my good friend Richard Miles of 29P, Swackman 1, which is in outburst again. Can't believe it. This is comic. This gives and gives and gives. For anybody who's...
Swackman?
Yeah. It's a 15-year orbital period. It was originally discovered in November the 15th, 1927. The last perihelion was July 10th, 2004. The next one is March the 7th, 2019. It has an orbital eccentricity of 0.0441. This comet is forever keeping us on our toes. I think most of my eye telescope points these days go to taking regular images. This is a 10-minute imaging session. This comet takes 10 minutes to image.
Faint one.
It's faint, but you saw the picture I put into our chat box on Skype. It's there. It is clearly visible, and you can see there's a lot of activity. Mm-hmm. So as soon as we get off the air, I'm putting some information on it. Whoops, let's not turn the tenor over. And I'm going to be getting it off to Richard Miles and his group. So busy, busy, busy.
I pulled up the data from ChasingComets.Skyhound and stating it's at about 12.4. Well, that'd be normal, but you said it was it brightened up, though, right? It flared
it's
up?
It brightened up, yeah.
Okay.
Well, just looking at the picture alone. Now, that picture I took this afternoon whilst I was at work, that was, you can see the moon affecting the image. You can also see how bright the comet is compared to some of the background stars. So if you look at it, you can see a definite tail, and it's bright, brighter than normal.
In our chat room, I put a link to star chart for it. Also, that usually gets transferred over to our Facebook page too, so you can check that out. It is not moving very quickly, that's for sure.
It's not, but the other thing is it doesn't come anywhere inside, or rather outside the orbit of Jupiter.
Uh-huh.
Now, the interesting thing is, unlike SL9, it hasn't foolishly got close enough yet to either be captured or to be shattered. Now, that's a good thing. However, we would love to see a space mission, because this baby... Basically, what happens is, as it rotates, it goes into outburst. As the heat starts to hit it, the actual crust is thought to be very, very thin in places, which allows it to jet. And think of the science you could do with a Rosetta-style space probe in orbit around Schwachmann-Wachmann-1.
Schwachmann.
Schwachmann-Wachmann.
It's not a schwack, it's a schwass.
I'm always getting told off for pronouncing that one by Michael.
S-C-H-W-A-S-S, Schwachmann.
I will take your word for it, Marty.
And it might be Wachmann too, but I'm not too sure about that.
Yeah. But I'm just trying to get it saved to my Pinterest so I can share it.
So I've got it pulled up on the star charts. It happens to be, by the way, in the constellation of Capricorn. Let's see, the far eastern star. Capricorn's kind of a big inverted triangle. The far eastern star, I can't remember, was that a gamma or something like that? It's kind of an O with a squiggle on top of it. I have to look that up. Anyways, it's just north of that by a few degrees. So Capricorn for Northern Hemisphere observers is well up at what time? About 2 in the morning. Looks like it's, let me pop this a little bit more. Okay, 3 in the morning, gets pretty much on the meridian. So that would be pretty much for anywhere, but obviously I'm using a northern hemisphere view. So about 3 in the morning is when I would be looking for this. I'll have to check it out. But you said it's brightening, but it actually is a pretty faint comet, so
it's one of those ones that goes into outbursts regularly.
Okay.
Now, the nice thing is, of course, it doesn't go far back into the outer solar system, mm-hmm. and it stays fairly close. So I can understand what's going on. Now, to be honest, go listen to Comet Watch when we had Richard Miles on it, because we spent the whole show discussing this one comet.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, it was fascinating. It certainly is worthy of a space probe mission on the style and expanse of Rosetta, mm-hmm. Purely because of what we could actually learn and see there. Now, Black Project is putting some links into the Earthrise Institute. That is run by my good friend Alan Hale. I do recommend going there. Buy and read his ebook. It is fascinating. I've got a copy. In fact, I bought the version 1 copy originally when he first published it. It got upgraded and everything, and he was very kind. He very kindly sent us all a version 2 free. Nice. So there's not many authors that do that, you know.
Skyhound Star Chart's actually improved from the last time I looked at one of these. It has a wide-angle view, which they usually only have a narrow-angle view. I put it in our chat room link, by the way. Oh, and by the way, come on over to the chat room, everybody, if you want to see links to the things that we're talking about and, you know, get a little bit more detail and stuff like that. Come on over to astronomy.fm/chat, or just go to the homepage. You'll see where it says radio chat. Click on that. Type in a name. And then hit login, and you'll be hearing and catch these links like this star chart link, which I said is much improved because it used to be really detailed with no general sky area, but now it's got a general sky area and a highly detailed chart below that. And you can also zoom in on the chart too, which is really kind of nice.
So now, the other thing I'm going to say is, I don't know what the heck I was going to say. Oh, yes, I was actually imaging this comet at 1643 UTC. Mm-hmm. I was also imaging it from Siding Springs because it's actually much easier to access Siding Springs than it is in other skies at the minute.
Yeah, for us Northern Hemisphere observers, it's pretty far south.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, it's still worth it. It's good fun, and I like using those scopes. I'm still trying to figure out how to wangle Tom on the AAT. That would be fun. I have 20 minutes on the AAT. What can I do?
There you go. But right. Should check this one out then and see if, well, keep looking for any visual reports on this one too. Now, for me, it's so far south, and I am north of a major city that my usual observing spots will not see this far south at all.
No. But like I say, I'm just bear me for a second because I am trying to get this picture onto my Pinterest so that I can actually share it with you all.
All right, go ahead. I'll say hi to everybody in our chat room right now. So far, it's you and me, Aquafew, Glenn, Starstorm, Black Projects, Cassie, Crowtown Skies, and Optronics. Glad to have you in our chat room tonight, everybody.
Okay, just one second.
In the meantime, by the way, I put a link to the sunspots. Go to the SOHO website and check out the sunspots because there is a really nice, very nice group just rotated on active region 2665, more towards the eastern edge of the sun. Just rotate on it by a day or two. It looks like it's a really nice group, almost as wide as Jupiter. So I'd say it's about as wide as the planet Saturn itself. So fairly large group that would put it about 75,000 miles across. Pretty easy to see. Should be naked eye if you have a solar filter. Hold it in front of your eyes. Without your telescope, just hold the filter in front of your eyes, look at the sun, and see if you can actually pick off the sunspot group. It's actually pretty impressive. Hopefully it's growing bigger and bigger. That'd be kind of nice. And if it's here now, in about a month, and it sticks around a month later, that would be a nice sunspot group for the eclipse. So we'll see how that goes. But this is a good time for practicing your solar photography. So if you plan on imaging the sun during the eclipse, image it now with a sunspot group on there. It'll give you plenty of practice. If you can pull up this group, get a good image of it, then you should be well practiced for the eclipse. And it's something I've got to do. I've been trying to practice on the moon. But I've been having some problems, so that's good. Actually, I was not able to get a dark enough exposure with my camera. For some reason, I can't dim it down far enough. The moon was overexposing. Now I'm going to try popping that picture into an image processor and see if I can dim it down and still pull out detail. But, okay, I see an issue that I've got to fix before the eclipse.
Now, I've put a link to the image into chat.
Nope.
I haven't had a chance to play with the image. I haven't put any information on it. But as you can see, the comet is right in the center of the image. And you can see a tail or the coma definitely there. As I say, this was a 10-minute exposure and pretty near full moon. And there was this big warning message throughout the whole of the actual imaging run. Warning, nearly full moon is affecting your image. So all that glare is from the moon. So mm-hmm. the fact that it got through that glare without any problems says something.
So you could get an image of it, to like technically there, though it's not going to be one of those.
It's not going to be one of those
publishable images.
It's not going to be a Damien Peach job. Yeah. As I say, I did actually try a color image, and it wasn't very good. But that's because the moon's in the way. Mm-hmm. Give it a few more weeks, the moon's going to be down, and you'll probably get a much better image. But as I say, we are trying to monitor this comet, so every image counts literally.
Yeah, we got full moon coming up in 2 days, actually. So, again, I've been encouraging everybody, start taking pictures of the moon as practice for the eclipse. So you get to know your equipment, know your settings, see if it's going to shake, stuff like that. So the moon being out in the early part of the evening is a great time for practicing, because the moon, especially the full moon, is the same size as the sun. So you can kind of calculate image size depending on the camera you have. If you have a cheaper camera and maybe no telescope, or a cheaper camera with a phone camera and a pair of binoculars, you might try pointing your binoculars at the moon and taking a picture through the binoculars to see if that works. It can be done, but it takes practice. You have to adjust the settings on your camera. So try shooting the moon this week as it gets to be full and a little bit past for practice for the eclipse. It will really help you when it comes to eclipse time.
Okay, you're saying about that, about imaging the moon, and I've got one here, which I think I put into chat for your last for Pirates, but got ignored. So
I've got I took a couple pictures of the moon a couple days ago, and I said I could not get it dimmed down enough. For some reason, yeah. It was always showing it overexposed. Now, it might be just the way the camera is not capturing the moon, I'm hoping, but maybe just the way it's presenting on my view screen. So I'm going to try popping it into image processing, work with the contrast, and what's the other one? Contrast and brightness. And see if I can dim it down and pull some detail out of the moon. If it does, I'll be more confident that I'll be able to get some decent pictures with this camera of the solar eclipse.
Right. For those of you who are saying that the previous link didn't work, this should now work. And just to test it myself.
Okay.
Waiting for Flickr. Yep, it's there. Anyway, so I put it into my Flickr account. I haven't done anything to it yet, but I'll mark it all up and repost it and take that one down shortly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there it is, a little smaller scale.
Yeah, but as I say,
your previous one, yep.
You can actually enlarge the picture in Flickr anyway.
Okay.
So I'm looking at a slightly enlarged picture. It's a bit grainier. I only wanted the luminance pass anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as you can tell, you can see how the moon is interfering with the shot. But the comet's there. It's for Mag 12 to Mag 13.5. That's a pretty darn good comet.
Yeah. Did you figure out an estimate of the brightness of the comet? You said it was kind of flaring up a little bit.
Well, as I say, it varies. The last one in last one last month. There was one last month, and they had it at 12.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just pop along to the BAA comet site, because they're normally pretty on top of it. So I'm just pulling that up right now.
Okay. Well, plus you got to have some, you know, good. Obviously, you're going to have good skies for this thing, no matter what. No matter where you live, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, you're going to have some decent skies, because it's just not a really, really bright.
It's a challenge. It's one of those comets that challenges you. So.
Yeah, I've tried some even with a big telescope and have not been able to see some that were like this. Once they get spread out, well, this one's actually looks like it's a bit concentrated. So,
they're saying that it's 13 magnitude 13 question mark on the as of July 3rd.
Okay, sounds like more of an imaging type of comet than anything else.
Oh yeah, it's definitely it's a challenge if you're a visual observer. Mm-hmm. And you really, you've got to have really good pristine skies. I wouldn't personally go for visual. I'd go for the camera every time.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it, compare it to, say, V2, which is at 8.5. Pan-STARRS ER61 is at 9. Both of those are fading.
Mm-hmm.
71P Clark is about 10.5. Panstars 2016 R2, that's 12. And then you're talking about 65P Gun, which is 13.5. And those are all either fading bright or steady comets, mm-hmm. but not 29P. 29P loves to vary. And as I say, the trick is to catch it. Well, as I say, I want a space mission there, so that's why we're actually doing this project.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just me. I also have to deal with the fact that my glasses are such that being varifocals, they are an absolute pain for visual observing. You're constantly moving up and down your face to find just the right spot. Mm-hmm. Now, that's fine. You find that spot, you have to look away for a second, then you've got to reacquire it. That's why I image. Apart from the fact that being on the dark side, we've also got brownies and hot chocolate afterwards. Sorry, I couldn't resist that.
Mm. But let me do a rundown of what's up in the sky this week. So tomorrow we got the moon at apogee. Yeah, the sun. The moon's at apogee, which means it is its farthest from the Earth. That'll be tomorrow. So we're going to get sort of almost a faraway full moon, a little smaller. Friday. Today. That was yesterday, Thursday. So today we've got Saturn is 3 degrees south of the moon. Sunday, full moon. Monday, Pluto at opposition, which I think is kind of right around Copernicus also. So I mean, Capricorn.
Copernicus is a crater. Marcy.
It is a crater. It's and a old guy too. Next Thursday, near Neptune, 0.9 degrees north of the moon. Occultation somewhere. I'll look that up and see, but usually means it's like, you know, down around Antarctica or something like that.
Yeah.
Next Friday, Venus, 3 degrees north of Aldebaran. I saw Venus over the past few days. I was out camping, got up really early in the morning, and there was this super bright object rising in the northeast. I was surprised how bright it was. It's like, oh, that's got to be Venus. But I was surprised especially at how far north it is. It's actually in the constellation of Taurus. In fact, I'm going to get my star chart. Surprise. It's like, whoa, that was really bright, but really, really far north. So let me get. So the Pleiades, yeah, that was definitely Venus. You'll see the Pleiades rising. And then Venus, got to get out, look at it early in the morning, just after it gets, you know, above your horizon. While the skies are still reasonably dark, you will be shocked at how bright it is. Probably like minus 4 degree magnitude, something like that. Venus is pretty spectacular right now. This guy.
It is, actually. And to be honest, one of the most fun things to do is to try and photograph the moon and Venus together.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've done it in the past, well, from here in Cahos very easily. So it's not a difficult thing to do. The trick really is to control your ISO,
mm-hmm.
particularly if you're using a DSLR. I try to make it as fast as possible just to cut down the actual shutter time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really taking a lot of pictures and then just going sorting through them, looking for that one special one.
Yep. So far, looks like it's going to be July the 20th is the target. Venus will be 3 degrees north of the moon. So get ready for Venus to be out in the early morning. And it's going to be kind of a bit of a crescent too, which is always nice around Venus.
Mm-hmm.
So take some pictures of that. And being as bright as it is, that means it'll be pretty easy to get a close enough exposure where you'll be able to get both the moon and Venus reasonably bright.
Now, the interesting thing for next weekend is that the tail of Scorpius is low in the south after darkness is complete. How low depends on how far north or south you live. The further south, the higher. Look for two stars, especially close together in the tail. Those are Lambda and fainter Upsilon Scorpii, known as the cat's eyes. Now, they are shown, I have put a link in here that shows the star chart with them. And as I say, you need to use the chart right at the top of the page to see the actual constellation layout, so you can recognize it when you're out there. Now, they're canted at an angle, and So the cat is tilting his head, and as if the cat is tilting his head and winking. Now, the cat's eyes point west, right, by nearly a fist width towards Mu Scorpii, which is an even tighter pair known as the little cat's eyes. Can you resolve Mu without using binoculars? It's a challenge. It's very hard. I can't. But then again, that's because I wear varifocals, and I know that I need new ones. So there you go. But there's a challenge for you. You can see the cat's eyes and the little cat's eyes, and if can you split them without binoculars?
I looked up Pluto. It's just east of the handle of the teapot in Sagittarius, kind of near a star called Aldebaran. So if you want to look for it, it's in a very star-rich region, though. It's going to be a little bit of a challenge figuring out which star is Pluto and which one is a lot of stars of the Milky Way.
You want a real challenge? In the UK, there's a place called Kielder. It's a small village in Northumbria, up in the borders with Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Now, depending on the time of year, and you get really clear skies, they are literally a dark sky haven.
Nice.
The campsite puts out all the lights at night, and when you actually acclimatize your eyes to the darkness, it is very difficult to actually make out constellations. The sky is so crowded with stars. Now, if you're in the UK and you can get up there, particularly at the tail end of autumn, I really recommend it. The last time I was there, I got to see the Milky Way overhead, which is a real treat.
Mm-hmm.
Even this far south in the US, it's so difficult because of the amount of light pollution. It's difficult in southern England. But there or places like the Brecon Beacons or the South Downs, you can actually do this. And when you're there, you are just like completely gobsmacked. You're just like, you just want to lie on the ground, look up, mm-hmm. and just lose yourself, because it is so difficult to actually make out constellations at the time.
I've seen skies like that too. Yes, mm-hmm. we've got some around here too. Yeah, unfortunately with Scotland, though, you get more, call it sky pollution from the sun during the summertime.
Yeah.
So far north that you get that twilight glow.
But this was autumn.
Yeah.
It had to be autumn because the kids were still at school.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Cayley in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who want to know what Cayley is, it is basically singing, dancing, drinking, and thoroughly enjoying yourselves, because most of the time everybody takes part, even if you just hum along and tap your feet. Most of us, after a few pints or a few glasses of whiskey, get up and dance. That can be fun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Black Projects can find a Scottish piece of Scottish dancing to put into chat room, or even I can. That's called Cayley dancing. It's good fun. I like it. Good way to get fit too.
Mm-hmm. I got to get back to Scotland again. I like that place.
It's got some good points. It's got some bad points, and those seams are a pain in the backside, literally.
Yeah.
But
bug sprays for.
Yeah, but you can then do yourself a mischief with that stuff.
Well, I kind of did that over the weekend. Actually, I was, using some bug spray on myself, and I was gonna get get the top of my head. I'll just kind of spray it over my head and let it kind of settle down on the top of my head. Well, turns out the sprayer at nighttime went at a different angle than I was expecting. Sprayed myself right in the eye.
Ow.
Yes, it was kind of hurting. So I managed to get inside, get to the sink, rinse my eye out as best I could. And I thought, oh, great. Am I going to see anything after this? But I'll know by the next morning. And mm-hmm. fortunately, it was okay. I got it flushed out just right. But yeah, it kind of hurt. It was a bad thing to do.
Absolutely. But as I say, there are points in the year you can get up there, you can get outside and enjoy yourself. Failing that, just buy a mozzie net and go down to the ex-army stores, ask them for a mosquito net,
mm-hmm.
Or even wear a beekeeper's veil.
Yep.
And that will keep most of them out, and you can still enjoy yourself. That's what I used to do a lot as well.
Make sure the mesh is fine enough for those things, though. Big mesh doesn't work too well.
No. But the stuff for beekeepers tends to be fairly fine anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that keeps them all the really determined little buggers out. Pardon my French.
Yeah. Well, they're bugs, so that's okay.
Yeah, we got to be careful, haven't we, Marty?
Exactly. By the way, it happens to be 9:30, halfway through our program. Yes, indeed. At least 9:30 our local time here at the Event Horizon radio program on astronomy.fm. And this, of course, a reminder again, is July the 7th, 2017. Now it's 9:31 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, making that universal time of 1:31, July the 8th, 2017, universal time. So we still have half of a live program. If you miss part of it, or if you're missing all of it, you might pick us up on repeat. We repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. But don't forget, we've got, at least after the show, we've got another 3 hours of continuing program before we do the repeat. So stick around. And I want to welcome everybody into our chat room right now. We've got, of course, you and me. We've got Aquafew, Glenn, Starstorm, Black Project, Cassie, Crowtown Skies, and Optronics listening in, in our chat room right now. So still plenty of room for more people in chat. Come on over. If you've got a question for us, you can ask us and we'll give the answer on air. We'll certainly say hi to you on air. And there's a good conversation going on in the chat room at all times anyways. So come on over.
And now, Marty and I were discussing something before we came on the air with Rob, our show producer, about Turid meteor showers having a dangerous side. Now, to be honest, take this as the pinch of salt, because nothing is really proven. I'm not 100% convinced. I'll put it in. We can discuss it. But how's about that?
Take it as a grain of meteorite dust.
Yes, even that. Now, Czech boffins say that the source of the Tunguska event has new asteroid-sized bits to watch. That's the headline. The regular and often unspectacular Turid meteor shower has a dangerous side, with Czech boffins warning it's a likely source of dangerous debris. Whoa. Sorry, couldn't resist. Working at the Czech Academy of Sciences, the authors of this paper at Astronomy and Astrophysics, there's a link to the actual paper, analyzed 144 fireballs observed in the 2015 Turid shower. And they say there's a previously undiscovered branch of the swarm that needs to be watched. Now, the Turids, of course, problems before. It's believed to have been the source of the famous 1908 blast near the stony Tunguska River. That was attributed to a 150-meter meteor from the swarm exploding in the sky over Siberia. Well, it's one of the largest swarms in the solar system, and the Turids are the source of 4 meteor showers each year, all probably a stream of fragments created when one or more large comets broke up about 30,000 years ago. Now, this is where I'm going to switch to a different page for a second, because I'm a member of the International Meteor Organization, and instead observers, and so they tell me that the actual parent object for the southern Turids is actually Comet 2P Encke.
Mm-hmm.
They have the radiant as being 0.2.808 plus 8.7 degrees, ZHR of 5, velocity of 17 miles a second. It's a slow one. But thing is, the Turids, we get two bites off. We have the southern Turids, which are active from September the 7th to November the 19th. And we have the northern Turids, which is October the 19th to December the 10th. Mm-hmm. Now, again, it is a slow shower. So they're saying the northern Turids has a ZHR of 5, a velocity of 18 miles per second. Again, it's dust from 2P Encke. But the radiant is slightly changed. It's 0.3.52 plus 22.7 degrees. Is it possible? Well, as they say, anything is possible. I'm not totally convinced yet. I am open to being convinced about this, but I would like to see some more information. And certainly what is being offered so far in this paper and I'm just flicking into the paper right now, see how much of it I can actually see. And mostly I'm getting an abstract.
It sounds like this would be a good one for checking out the quote-unquote dark side of the moon, if that's going to be favorable for this one, because we might get some impacts on the moon if it's got some bigger ones.
Well, in that case, this is probably a good time to start thinking about setting up a video camera pointing at the moon.
Yes.
And making sure you have a nice big hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
I would say at least 1 terabyte. Mm-hmm. And then just going through your images during the first quarter and a half, and then the last quarter of the moun, particularly when it's gibbous in both waxing and waning, because that's when you're most likely going to get some chances to see a strike.
Yep.
So it could be good fun. It also means that you want to use a telescope for something else, you can't, because I've actually seen a couple of the guys' setups for this. Mm-hmm. It is very, very difficult to suddenly change from videoing the moon to going to deep sky. Mm-hmm. It's going to take you about 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you've done it, it's look, it's dawn.
Yeah.
Oh well,
yep.
Put it back,
or stick with check out astronomy social media and see if anybody reports a lunar strike, and then you can figure out what time it is, and then go back to your video for that time and see if you can actually confirm a meteor strike. If you don't want to go back through all the whole video, which can actually take quite a few hours of constant watching, you might want to watch 20 minutes at a time, then stop it, and then go back later, watch 20 minutes at a time, check yourself, but watch astronomy social media and see if anybody else reports seeing a strike on the moon from a meteor.
Now, the NASA site that's dealing with this, as my head reminds me, is Johnson, I believe. So let me just pull up that information.
Okay.
NASA lunar strikes.
So we'll have to check out the moon.
Marshall. And it's actually the Marshall Space Flight Center.
Okay.
So
a little extra fun project.
Yeah. And actually, it's actually one you could actually get very, very seriously into.
Mm-hmm.
Because in December 23rd of 2005, they had a rare meteor strike on the moon. But it is an ongoing thing. Now, Brian Lukid is the guy who's in charge of this. And he wrote a really, really good book about this, so I really do recommend that book. Let me just see what I can find, because that's Laddie. That's not what I'm looking for. But as I say, Google it, and I do believe it's either Marshall or Johnson that runs the program, and they want you, and they want your help as well.
It sounds like it'll be definitely a good one to not just the Perseids, but another meteor shower to go out and observe this time. It's got the potential of some big ones.
Well, yeah, you've also got – this is an ongoing project. We're going back to the moon, so we're told, and we're going to Mars. Well, guess what? If that's the case, we do need to catalogue these things. We need to find perhaps where the sweet spot on the moon is that isn't hit, or hit so much that everybody has to go into a lava tube to take cover.
That's right.
So I suspect that NASA is probably going to be considering building their base somewhere near a decent lava tube on the moon so everybody can get in there pronto, even during a solar storm.
Mm-hmm. So sounds like another meteor shower to get out and observe this year. So that'd be a good one.
Yeah, it should be.
As I say, go out there, bring friends, or as I sometimes say, shower with a friend.
That could be misunderstood, Marty.
Exactly. Well, welcome Richie to our chat room. Just joined us. Thank you very much.
But, anything you can do like that just adds more and more to our knowledge. We don't know everything about the moon, and I don't think we're ever going to do. But you know what? It's worth trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Looks like solar wind speeds are pretty slow. Give you a quick report of speeds of 289 kilometers per second. That's actually pretty slow. Particle density pretty low, 3.31 protons per cubic centimeter. So low and slow. Don't expect much auroral activity by that report anyway.
Having said that, there is a radio aurora right now.
Okay.
I am looking at my handy-dandy solar gadget, courtesy of November Os Zero, November Bravo Hotel. And it is saying that there is an aurora latitude of 67.5 degrees.
Pretty high up.
Pretty high up, yeah.
Well, pretty – well, now is that south or is that north?
It just says 65 degrees, and all my stuff is orientated for the northern hemisphere.
Okay, so – Southern Hemisphere probably has a much better chance of catching some aurora if there is enough activity out there. Mm-hmm.
Well, the geomagnetic field is quiet at the moment, mm-hmm. and the signal noise generated by the sun, which is ever present on radio, mm-hmm. is about S1 to S2, so it's not that bad. And it says the maximum usable frequency as of US Boulder is 13.23. Lots of information there.
Let's check it out, our chat room. It looks like the big discussion happens to be on Aqua for You has this telescope, I think from the 40s, something like that. He's trying to clean it up and trying to get the lens retainer ring loosened up to clean the lenses. So it's a discussion on using a spanner wrench, because that ring usually has a couple of slots in it, and twisting that ring up. Different type of spanner ring wrench from the U.S. to UK-ish. Spanner wrench here is basically, how would I describe it? Something that, well, a ring that has a couple slots cut in. It's a wrench that would actually fit those slots, as opposed to a, which we call a crescent wrench, which is...
Oh, you mean a monkey wrench.
A monkey wrench is different from a crescent wrench. Monkey wrench is considered more of a pipe wrench. It has a big teeth in it for biting into pipe. Whereas a crescent wrench is an adjustable wrench. It gets, you know, wider and smaller depending on the nut that you need to unscrew with it. But I guess in the UK that's called a spanner wrench, I believe.
Right, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to see it, yeah.
So the spanner wrench here, it's got basically two kind of like screwdrivers on a bar. So you can adjust the distance between the two of them, put it in the slots of the ring, and twist it loose.
Oh, I loved those. I used to take them cycling with me everywhere. I used to have a nice big heavy duty one in my backpack, so if I had a problem with my bike wheel, I could just get off and sort it. Mm-hmm. It's also very good when someone tries to mug you as well. They're not expecting that one.
I'll have to look up the source for the name Monkey Wrench. I don't know if that was a brand name at one time. A lot of times tool names come from the brand that was actually popular at the time. Like one of the first adjustable wrenches was called a crescent wrench, and that's because that was a brand name. We're diverging here a little bit.
It says a monkey wrench is an adjustable wrench with large jaws that has an adjusting screw contained in the handle.
Okay, so that would be a pipe.
They're known as gas grips in the UK.
Gas grips are because of the gas pipe.
Yeah.
Would make sense. Okay.
In fact, it's actually an American development of the 18th century English coach wrenches.
Ah.
Didn't know that, did you?
You didn't either until you just read it.
No. But it's also a sabotage, especially as a form of protest, sticking a monkey wrench into it.
Oh, that's true too, yes. I get a little alert notice from the American Association of Variable Star Observers. Well, two things about them, by the way. Their website's going to be down for maintenance July the 10th for approximately a couple hours. But alert notice 586, they want observers to observe 20 cataclysmic variable stars because they're going to be using the William Herschel Telescope in La Palma. To look for cataclysmic variables in outbursts. So they need amateur astronomers to monitor 20 of these variable stars now. And hopefully if you see one in outburst, you can let them know and they can do their observations. So I'll put that link into our chat room. One of the, again, continuing ways that you could actually help professional astronomers with amateur astronomer equipment.
This is interesting. I didn't know that. They're also known as forward wrenches.
Forward wrenches?
Forward, as in the motor car.
Oh, because okay. Wait. I'm not familiar with a forward motor car.
A forward wrench.
Yes. I thought you said forward.
No.
Yes. I've heard that term before. Ford wrench. Yes, they used to include one with every like Model A or something
like
that.
That's right. They used to be in the toolkit supplied with every Ford Model A. Mm-hmm. Because it came in black.
And if I recall, the handle was kind of a bent wire. The jaws were not toothed. They were flat. And it did have the adjusting screw. Got a picture of it?
Yes, I have, I believe. Let me just put the link into chat.
Check it out and see if it looks like that. Yes, like a bent wire handle. And see if that's what they're talking about for a Ford wrench, if I'm not mistaken. In the meantime, we'll talk about here's an article. Mars surface, they're thinking, is more uninhabitable than previously thought because of some of the chemicals they found in it. And the surface, mostly perchlorates, which they've done some experiments on that actually kills cultures of bacteria. This is Bacillus stabilis, a basic life form. But they think that the perchlorates in the Mars soil, basically the salts areas, will actually kill any bacteria. So, again, reducing the chances for being able to actually find living organisms on this organisms. On the surface. I corrected myself here. It is one of those nights.
Yes, it is.
Anyways, yes, kill living organisms on the surface of Mars if there is any. So they would definitely probably have to go deeper if they can stay away from that type of salt. But yes, definitely reduced chance of life on Mars. According to this study, because of the perchlorates there. And I'll put that link into our chat room.
Apparently, it's all good. These guys are pros. We didn't distract them that much.
Now, they're into their telescope taking apart talking in our chat room right now. So they're not even talking. They're not even...
They're not even paying attention to us.
Not even paying attention. That's right. So, kind of like that episode of The Big Bang Theory. You ever watch that one? Yeah. And these guys are seriously into, they're seriously into a video game, and the girls walk in and they, you know, try to flirt with them, and the guys don't even hear what they're saying. Aqua says, no, we're listening.
Mm-hmm. That's called multitasking. I thought only women multitask properly, so I'm told.
Mm. Monkey rat, monkey what?
Oh dear! Gotta love it when you can catch them like that.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you what, my two favorite episodes of the Big Bang Theory was William Shatner's appearance and Adam West.
I saw that Adam West one; that was pretty funny. Yeah.
That was hilarious. The guy used to send himself up so well, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Oh dear!
But the one I caught, the bad science, was everybody look this one up again. Is when they use telescopes. And they shoot a laser beam at the moon to hit the reflector, and it comes back down, and they get an image of that, you know, that laser light. The telescopes are pointing the wrong way.
So big surprise.
Go back over those episodes. Yes, they, mm-hmm. like a lot of movies and television shows and stuff like that, they mount a telescope like you would see an advertisement for it, you know, mm-hmm. with the mount all definitely lined up. On the meridian, pointing due north.
Yeah.
So they line the telescopes up that way, which means no. Now, even if you take that telescope and turn around, point it towards the south, you can't look around in that area because it's kind of locked in. You have to actually point it, you know, towards the north and then turn the telescope towards the south to be able to point it at the object and track it. So there's no way they were actually tracking the moon with the mounts pointed backwards, basically.
My other favorite thing I like to nitpick, I got two actually. A, the fact it took Neil deGrasse Tyson giving David Cameron a hard time over his night sky in Titanic. I love that one.
Uh-huh.
And the other one, of course, is Contact with Jodie Foster, where she plugs a pair of headphones in as to listen to the take from The Dish.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I always say is when she's doing that, she's listening to astronomy.fm radio.
Possibly, but she ain't listening to the whatever the telescope was aimed at.
No, I don't think so.
I actually had the chance to listen. They played what was the receiver was getting, and to be honest, all you could hear was pop, 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 pop. That's the type of thing you might get to hear, particularly if you're tuned to the decametric frequencies and you're looking at Jupiter with a radio telescope. Mm-hmm. There you're actually going to hear something. You're going to hear a lot of the static discharges in the Jovian atmosphere. But pointing it at, say, Sagittarius A, and then making out you can actually hear it, that is bad science.
Mm-hmm.
And that really does take the Darwin Award for bad science, I think.
Yeah, you have to convert the radio signal into an audio signal. And then when you convert it, basically it's like, what do they call it? Artistic license.
Yes.
On how you wish to modify it to be able to hear it. You could change the frequency. You could change the speed. Everything else, modify on how it's actually played back. So in audio, so you can make it high frequency, low frequency, you know, a lot of variables on how you can actually modify radio signal to actually be heard.
Well, the thing is, I'm sure everybody remembers the link I put in about the sound of the meteorite hitting LDO. That was done by taking the sampling the spectrum and reducing it with artistic license to an audio frequency. That allows us to hear the actual bing when the lunar probe got hit.
Mm-hmm.
And we all saw the image where it was all jiggled because they were actually imaging at the time. But the only way you can do that is to take sophisticated software and you reduce it to an audible frequency. Well, you manipulate it to make it something that could be listened to.
Right. Like that recording that the guy modified. I think it was, I think we talked about this last week. Was it us or someone else? Cicadas?
We talked about it a few weeks ago.
The cicadas.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. That he played it back super slow so you can hear the sounds stretched out a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to hear it that way, too. But
now,
definitely, he had to modify it in order to – probably modified it several times to get something more pleasing to listen to.
Now, the thing is, this trick as well allowed ESA to actually listen in to what one of their satellites was doing. They did something very, very similar using accelerometers to hear the spacecraft during an orbit. And they had to fire the motors on Olympus, which was a communication satellite that was being used for NASA Mir television hops. Because you've got to remember, most of the world isn't on not the same color twice. It's either on SECAM or it's on PAL. So what was happening was the European Space Agency's technical center near Noordwijk was taking the signal from Mir, which had been on a Russian standard,
mm-hmm.
which I believe is SECAM, or maybe it's the French standard. Anyway, then they would convert it and retransmit it for the American TV audience or push it to NASA at the TV standard used by the United States. So what they wanted to do was they wanted to actually monitor the performance of the spacecraft, and somebody had this brilliant idea. Well, we've got accelerometers on this thing. We can actually produce a sound so that we know when the thrusters are firing. And they actually listened and recorded the thrusters fire. I've got the tape lying around here somewhere of the recording because I was given a copy of it. It was really it's really something spectacular because you can hear the boing boing boing. And you can hear the spacecraft reacting to the commands. It's not the rocket engine you hear on maybe Galaxy Quest or Star Trek or something. It's an actual conversion to something audible that the human ears and the human brain understand. Because it is vibration. They're recording vibration. Mm-hmm. And then they scale it down to our narrow bandwidth for us to enjoy. If you could say it's an enjoyable sound. But anyway, that is the whole process that was done there. And so when somebody says, oh, I've recorded this, that, and the other from a satellite, what they've done, they've taken the vibration, they've dropped it using software to something that we can listen to and we can understand a sound.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all fun and games. It does have its interesting side, and particularly with attached to the image that shows the actual hit, it makes it all the more spectacular. It also brings home, perhaps, the reality of the fact that space is not empty.
Yeah,
it's full of stuff, pretty much. Not always in the same place, but there is patches of stuff that can do us a lot of harm, particularly in space missions. Mm-hmm. The fact it wasn't an actual manned spacecraft was probably a very good thing. If it had been slightly bigger, we might have lost the actual lunar probe.
Mm-hmm.
But what can you do?
Got a question for you in our chat room.
Yes.
This would be right up your alley. Can you hear the Big Bang on normal radio static?
No. If anybody who has an analog television, when the stations used to shut down, the static you see there is the microwave background.
That was the visual static, though, not the audio static, correct?
That's the visual static.
Because the audio is broadcast on a different frequency than the video, if I recall.
Yes, it is. But when you see the static on a TV after the station has shut down, that is the cosmic microwave background you're seeing.
So what would be radio static?
Radio static pretty much is created by the solar wind and the sun. So when you think about it, if you have, say, a very violent solar event, and you listen to a radio, you'll hear the static rise, signal strength rise, and then everything blacks out. Radio gets blacked out because of the solar event.
So radio, static from a normal radio is mostly solar. Old style television, the fuzzy staticky picture, which you can not just wait till the station turns off, but tune it to an off station. In fact, pretty much any of those old TVs, if you turn them on now, you won't get any image, obviously, because they've all gone digital. So any of that static now is Big Bang static on old style TV. So well, it'd be kind of a fun thing to get. You can still get them at some charity stores and stuff like that, thrift stores. So pick up one of those old black and white televisions and turn it on just for astronomy party sometime and say, hey, everybody, this is, by the way, happens to be a visual of the Big Bang.
Yeah, basically the static you hear on a radio, a lot of that is mostly solar. You might hear Jupiter occasionally. The weaker the signal gets, the further the object is. But the visual stuff on the old style analog TVs, all you really need to do is just to turn it on and it can pick it up.
Mm-hmm. How about normal radio static?
Normal radio static is pretty much driven by the solar wind.
Okay, and so how can we hear it? The question is, so how can we hear it at nighttime?
Because the solar wind isn't it's not like light. The solar wind goes everywhere. If you think about the way that the Van Allen belts deflect it, it goes like a bow shock around the planet. So it's pretty much, it hits the planet and it splits and it goes right around. So it doesn't matter. You don't have to be, it doesn't have to be nighttime or daylight. You can still hear it.
So on that last staticky note, it's time for us to head out of here, everybody.
Captain Savick, 3 to beam up. ASAP, please.
Good night, all.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.